responsible, because when he was running away to save his own life, he knew that in some sense he was endangering the Givonim. Anybody happen to remember how he expresses that just in the last 2 weeks? What was David's feeling of guilt? What was the origin of that? Why did he feel that he was to blame for something that was manifestly outside of his control? What was his what was the basis of his guilt? Okay. I think Effie, as usual,
he didn't recognize that
Doeg.
Doeg Aldumi was there at the time, and that therefore he was working for Shaul.
Right. Well, so he says, I knew Doeg was there. He knew what he was capable of. Yeah, go ahead, Effie. Sorry.
And he didn't realize that he was going to be under. He would tell Shaul that David's there in the area.
Right. Or, like, you know, maybe he did, you know. But he said, right, I knew that Doeg was there that day. And the idea is that I kind of put myself and my own interest, you know, in front of, you know, these Kohanim and Nov, and by extension, the Givonim. So, you know, what my mother was arguing over the course of the last few weeks was that, you know, David really knows this the whole time, and maybe that was ultimately the answer to the question as to why he waits 3 years before acting in any way to end the famine. Like, maybe there's this sense of foreboding that he has that this is now the comeuppance for everything that, you know, had sort of been part of the deep past, and now it's emerging, which I thought was a very persuasive argument that my mother was making, and there's a kind of an avoidance there. And the third factor that we have to consider is, again, who is David trying to save? You know, if the idea is he'll get involved because it's the lesser evil, who does he want to save in this story?
Everybody from the family.
Mephibosheth.
Right, Mephibosheth. I couldn't. That was Ruthie. Okay, Ruthie. It's good.
Sorry, my camera's not working. I have to like shut down to restart it, so I apologize.
I know that voice. I know it's you. Ruthie's absolutely right. So he's trying to save Mephibosheth, and so that you know gives him this permission structure to do what otherwise would be, you know, from our point of view, rather unthinkable. So that's kind of where we had left off. In general, we would say that Sefer Shmuel is probably, you know, not for the faint of heart. But the rest of this chapter is going to be, you know, particularly, you know. So if anybody, like, you know, especially the ones behind the Zoom screens are like eating, you know, I don't want to upset anybody's stomach. So I just this like consider yourself, you know, to have been warned, you know, for the for what follows. Okay, so here we are. So let's take a look at the next section. So Vayechmol HaMelech, this is, you follow my cursor, Al Mephibosheth ben Yehonatan ben Shaul, Al Shuar Hashem Asher ben Otam. So David says, we're not handing over Mephibosheth, right, because that's a promise that he made. Ben David uven Yehonatan ben Shaul. Vaykach HaMelech at Shnei Bnei Ritzpah. So now he actually takes people to hand them over. And so he takes the two sons of Ritzpah Vataya, Asher Yaldal Shaul. They were sons of Shaul, but from Ritzpah. We'll come back to that. At Armoni Vet Mephibosheth, happened to be that one of them was named Mephibosheth as well, but not the Mephibosheth to whom David has his deep personal allegiance. Vet Chameshet B'nei Michal Bat Shaul. Now the five sons of Michal Bat Shaul, Asher Yaldal Adriel Ben Barzilai HaMecholati. So this requires like a word of background. Of course, Michal had been married to David. So how exactly does she have five children with this Adriel? So this is actually the source in the Gemara for the idea that adopting children or raising somebody else's children is considered like mothering or fathering them yourself. All kinds of halachic implications, by the way, for adoption beyond our scope for this evening. But Michal had actually raised five children that were not her own. Anybody remember the story of Michal's own, you know, very tragic story as a mother? This is sort of like relevant here. And this is a particularly brutal thing to have to contemplate, but it's there, so it's in front of us. What do we know about Michal as a mother in terms of biological children?
She didn't have children, right?
That's right. That's exactly right. Let me just see. I want to make sure I get who that was. Ina? Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Excellent. So It sounds that way. Remember, she has this confrontation with David, this horrible argument. Anybody remember what it was over?
Yeah, when David brought the Mishkan and was dancing before, so she didn't like how he, like she reprimanded him that he was not was not dignified enough.
Okay,
how he,
yeah, right, exactly. So, right, she's scathing, right, and she's really mortified by this behavior, right? Ma nichbad hayom melech Yisrael, right? She excoriates him for what she perceives to be extremely undignified behavior, and how does David respond? That's sort of his. He gives as good as he gets, right? What does he say? Who remembers David's response? So this is what leads into the fact that Michal never becomes a mother. Seems that way. So David says, basically, you pretentious, you know, entitled person, you know, you think it's beneath me that I should, you know, be dancing with the Jewish people. Well, you know, if you're ever wondering to yourself why God chose me instead of your father, that's the answer. Because, you know, you're his daughter and you don't understand that I'm a servant of the people. I'm not meant to, you know, sort of separate myself from them or, you know, perceive myself as somehow more important than they are. V'im ha-mahos asher amar timami kaveda, right? He says, and I consider it an honor to be with the Jewish people. And then the Navi tells us, like, very tragically, that Michal never had children of her own. So now, you know, in case that wasn't, you know, sort of sad enough, right, what we have here is now even worse. So she raises these five children, you know, who were left orphaned, apparently. And these are the ones that David chooses to hand over to the Givonim. So you have the two sons of Rizpah and the five adopted children of Michal. And all, right, to honor his agreement with Mephibosheth. Okay, Eva, I see you, you know, shake. Okay, please, weigh in. This is, yeah, go ahead, Eva.
No, I was just upset that he picked the Michal's kids.
I knew that's what you were reacting to. It's hard to take. I mean, it's very, like I said, I tried to warn people. This is a little rough right here. What about Rizpah Varaya? Who remembers who she is? What's her background? How does she factor in? Effie, can we impose on you? She's only appeared once before.
I don't recall.
More of an esoteric character, but also very important.
Don't recall.
Is she a Pelegesh?
Yes. Yes. More. Absolutely right. Clearly, you know, Shaul's Pelegesh. But Ruthie, where does she come up and why is it important?
I'm trying to remember.
Okay. Can I give you a hint?
Please.
Okay, think about Ishbosheth and Avner.
Oh.
There you go. Okay.
I mean, I might be off, but I'm trying to remember when there was the whole episode with coming in, like,
So remember, Avner is the Ramatkal. He's the chief of staff to Shaul. And Ishbosheth is sort of this weak figure, and Avner is propping him up. And it's very ambiguous in the text as to what actually happened, but Ishbosheth accuses Avner of having a relationship with Rizpah Varaya, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, Avner is really incensed by this accusation, true or untrue, and that's what leads to the defection, right? Avner then defects over to David's side, at least for a minute, you know, until Yoav slaughters him in cold blood. So Rizpah Varaya is somebody who's up until this point just been sort of the object of a discussion, but we don't know anything about her character. She's about to really be the heroine tonight in an otherwise just, you know, very, very difficult chapter. You know, we're going to encounter her courage and depth and what makes her such a compelling figure. Okay, so yeah, Mom, go ahead.
How many candidates were there to be offered up, you know, as sacrifice? Like, was there 20 people to choose from, or was there 7 people to choose from? Because it's a little bit callous for him to take Michal's kids. Not that anybody's kids are, you know, more worth more or less, but how many possible heirs are there to volunteer for this job?
Okay, so that is a really incisive question. And some of the Rishonim actually take the position that there were only 8. In other words, Mephibosheth plus the 7. And clearly the impetus would be that that would be a mitigating factor for David. But I agree with the other point that you were insinuating also. In other words, that I don't know if that makes it any better. The result is still the result, but you know, at least it means that he wasn't targeting anybody in particular. So here we have it. Oh boy, Vayitnem b'yad ha-givonim. So he hands them over. Now again, that word Vayitnem is really important because that's the, you know, the critical word, the halachic word to describe the givonim are the nesinim, the people who were placed initially as chot ve'etzim v'shoa ve'mayim, Vayitnem Yoshua. Now Vayitnem b'yad ha-givonim. So they're handed over. Vayoki'um bahar lifnei Hashem. And they execute them and they string up their bodies. Vayiplu shevatam yachad. They died all 7 together. Vehema humtu bimek katsir barishonim b'tchilat katsir sarim. So it's the beginning of the harvest season in terms of the barley. Okay, so everybody knows that the omer, which comes from barley, that's offered on the 16th of Nisan. So just to localize it a little bit. Vatikach ritzpa vataya tasak. This is a matter of months. So what Ritzpah does is she takes this blanket of sorts and she covers the bodies. And, you know, you can't just do that for, you know, like a moment, but she does it for months, from the beginning of the harvest season until the rainy season, so let's say a cheshvan, so basically like, you know, it could be half a year. And she protects the bodies from, particular dishonor that would have come, you know, from, you know, the natural course of events, which would be for the Ofa Shamayim and the Chayat HaSadeh to, you know, mutilate them. Now, let's just try to think about, you know, the meaning of this. There are 7, 2 of them are hers. It'd be one thing to have the courage to do this, you know, for a moment. That would itself be, you know, a kind of a remarkable recommendation of a person. To do this day after day after day after day, so that is really a superior level of courage, and to be able to deal with that. So up until now, all we know about Ritzpah Varaya was she was a Pilagesh Ruthie, as you mentioned, and, you know, she's the subject of a fight between Avner and Ishbosheth that has, you know, all kinds of consequences on a national level. But here we're meeting somebody, you know, who up until now, we never would have known this, we couldn't have known it, but she's demonstrating great depth of character, a great sense of purpose and values, and it's moving. And Vayugad David et asher asta Ritzpah Varaya Pileges Shaul. David is told about, you know, who this person is and what she's done. And now again, you know, David is the one who allowed this to happen. Maybe it was the right thing. You know, maybe, you know, he felt like, you know, the national interest was at stake. People were going to die in the famine. He's personally responsible. We noted last week that this is why he bans the Givonim. The Givonim can never marry into the main body of the Jewish people, so he's trying at some level to still stigmatize this kind of brutal behavior. But in the end of the day, right, here you have Ritzbah, who's, you know, a Pilagesh, so she's not like, you know, from the aristocracy in any sense, but she's acting in this deeply noble way, and that moves David. So Vayelach David Vayikach, at this point, at Atzmot Shaul, at Atzmot Yonatan Beno, made Balei Yavesh Gilad. You remember the story that the Plishtim had taken the bodies of Yonatan and Shaul. Anybody remember this story? We'll be able to sort of connect it back to Ritzbah, but it will help us understand why Ritzbah was such an inspiration to David. What happened to the bodies of Yonatan and Shaul after the battle of the against the Plishtim? So remember, the Plishtim killed them in battle. Effie, yeah, go ahead.
I think the Plishtim, they didn't allow the Jews to get the bodies. They took them.
Right, but so the Plishtim, but what did they first, you know, do to the bodies?
I think they displayed them.
Yes, exactly. They dismembered them and they displayed them on the wall. And remember, then the Anshei Yavesh Gilad actually go on a night mission and they bring the bodies back to Israel for burial. But the bodies were never, properly, you know, buried in a royal ceremony. And the bodies had been, you know, really disrespected. So once David hears about Ritzbah's courage in terms of protecting the integrity of the body, so he's stimulated to action that, you know, could have taken place decades before. And he goes and he takes the bodies, you know, back, Shaul's body and Yonatan's body, from the people of Yavesh Gilad, and he gives them a proper burial. Asher ganvu otam mirechov Beit Shan, asher tla'um sham ha-plishtim, biyom ha-ko plishtim, et Shaul ba-gilboa, v'yal misham et atzmot Shaul, but atzmot Yonatan b'no, v'yasfu et atzmot ha-mukaim. Not only that, but David takes the bones of the seven, the two sons of Ritzbah, and the five sons, adopted sons of Michal, along with the bones of Shaul and Yonatan, and buries them all. He returns them to the Kever Avot, to the family burial plot. And that's a great kavod that he gives them. They do all that the king commanded. According to some views, this means that they finally gave Shaul a hesped kalacha, that they properly eulogized him. And then God brought the rains. So again, you have this very fascinating dialectic. On the one hand, right, all of Shaul's, you know, sins are being brought to bear and exposed, and, you know, the givonim and the retribution against his household is, you know, very severe. And on the other hand, the fact that Shaul himself, you know, wasn't, you know, properly nisbad, wasn't properly eulogized, so that too, you know, is addressed within in this same context. And then, you know, the rains come sort of to purify the earth. Now, I just wanted to sort of like take half a step back and then, you know, sort of discuss this. You know, we know that this issue of displaying bodies is a very, very sensitive one from a halachic point of view. The Torah tells us, you have it here in the fifth source, in Parshas Ki Tse, that displaying bodies, even those who have committed capital offenses and, you know, have been executed, is totally antithetical to, you know, our value system, our halachic tradition. So just to, again, you know, sort of, you know, reflect on this, there are 18 different crimes in the Torah for which a person can, in principle, get the punishment of skila. Skila is the most severe of the four capital penalties, skila, sreifa, harigan, chanek, in that order. Only two of the 18, this is according to the majority view, Rabbi Eliezer says, kol niskal nitlin, that anybody who's stoned is in fact hanged, but we don't accept that view. L'halacha, we accept the view of the Chachamim, that only two of the 18, somebody worshipped Avodah Zarah, or somebody who's guilty of blasphemy of Birkas Hashem. So we're talking about the worst of the worst. So skila, subcategory of niskalin, are subject to the din of tliya, of hanging. And even so, right, the Torah says, Lo salin ivlaso al ha'etz. You are not allowed to display the bodies. The way that this was done in practice was that they were literally hanged for a minute, right before Shkia, and then they were let down. Ki kavortik brenu bayom ahu, ki kilolas Elohim talui, velo setamer es admascha, asher Hashem Elokach hanosein lecha nachala, so that you shall not defile the land. By the way, it happens to be, it's really interesting, that this is the source in the Torah for the mitzvah of kavura. That's why we always try to bury as soon as possible. And I think what's really, you know, fascinating about this, well, let me open it up. Let me see if anybody agrees. I better to do it that way. Why do you think, of all places, you know, you would think that burial is something so generic, it would have probably been more logical for the Torah to have some kind of a pasuk that says, you know, you have to bury people. Why would the Torah localize it to a situation of capital offense? What's the value added there?
You might think that maybe those people deserving of punishment, maybe, you know, maybe they're not requiring the same honor because they already have a certain level of guilt, perhaps.
Yeah. So, Ruthie, you said it better than I could. In other words, that there are certain, you know, inalienable rights. And, you know, from a halachic standpoint, the idea of kavod hames, of honoring, you know, those you know, who have passed away, no matter what the circumstances of their death were, even if it was a capital, you know, punishment, and no matter what the substance of their life was, right, there are certain boundaries that we don't cross. So that's exactly right. That's why the source for the mitzvah of kavura is specifically in this context, because it demonstrates that, you know, this is not, you know, something that a person earns, you know, by good behavior, but this is inalienable. This is an outer boundary where we don't cross this threshold, no matter, you know, what kind of a life a person had. We don't ask the question, you know, when somebody needs a burial, a meis mitzvah, like, you know, what were their deeds? You know, this is just something that, you know, is axiomatic. It's reflexive. We have to. And so, you know, the Torah says not doing it is, you know, a matter of gravity. It's very severe. V'lo setameh es admascha, asher Hashem Elokach hanosein lecha nachala. You don't carry this out, so there'll be this kind of a tumas haaretz. Now, the Ramban has a really fascinating theory, and he suggests that this pasuk tells us that halanas hameis, leaving a body exposed, is actually a second violation in the land of Israel. In other words, if you do it anywhere in the world, so you'd be guilty of the iser, the oraisa lo sala nivlaso al eitz, that you're not allowed to leave a body overnight. Now, again, in practice, we don't bury right away if it's not lechvodo shalmeis. So let's say if, you know, this allows people to get to the funeral, or this will allow the body to be buried in the family plot or in the land of Israel or other such things. But basically, we try to bury as soon as we can. And that's true anywhere in the world. But the Ramban makes the argument, you know, as he would, that with respect to the land of Israel, leaving a body over is even more severe, which is why, by the way, in Israel, you know, they bury even quicker, right? They don't have to deal with the union laws of no burial at night, you know, and all those issues. But, you know, they're very, very concerned about this, because the Ramban's position is velo setameis ad mascha, means that if you would violate this in Israel, there would be an additional Torah-level violation. So that's a point of interest here as well. But the Ramban is very struck, you know, by this story, and he relates to it already in his Perush al Torah. So I'm just going to read, I think, which is a very fascinating argument that he makes, and then, you know, circle back as we conclude our 3-week discussion of this topic. So he says, "Valdati ha'inyan b'vnei shalom ukaim, mipnei shelo hayu tluyim b'vestin shel Yisrael v'lo miyad Yisrael klal." So the first thing the Ramban points out is that it's true that David allowed it to happen, but it was the Givonim who did this. The Givonim killed them, and the Givonim then allowed their bodies to be exposed. Well, David nisanam the Givonim, lasos behem kiritzonam. David allowed it. Ve'heim asher hokiyum ve'lo ratzu l'kavram. And the Givonim alone were the ones, you know, who decided not only to execute these individuals, but to display their bodies in a way that, as we said, is completely foreign to, you know, everything that we stand for. And it's ultimately why David, you know, proscribed marrying with the Givonim, banned them from the main body of the Jewish people. Lefarsim nikmasam mehem v'anisharim yishmu v'yiro. Right? The Givonim were interested in doing this for the obvious reason that they thought this made it clear that anybody, you know, in the future, you know, who would harm their community, as Shaul had, you know, would pay a terrible price. V'chasher nitach aleihem mayim min hashamayim, and only once it started raining again after years, az yada David shenim chalavunam. And David knew that expiation had come to the land. V'netar Elohim la'aretz kifakad Hashem es ha'aretz b'matar v'chaleh ha'ra'av. That when the drought ended, then automatically, right, then, you know, the ground was, you know, able to grow crops again. V'az tziva v'kaviro samim avosam l'chvod ha'malchus. As we noted, that's when David, you know, wants to, you know, bury them all properly. Lo l'chiyuv v'klal, shalom nitzavinu ela, shalom nitami anachnu esaret, samishin et losos. The Rabban says, look, it wasn't really David's fault. David wasn't personally responsible for this, but he was inspired to do it. And the Ramban says it was a matter of kavod hamalchus. After all these individuals were part of the house of Shaul. V'nei, Hashem lo ratza avunam b'tliyasa miyad, lohodiya ki Hashem ohev geirim k'divei rabbeinu. So the Ramban says the reason that the rains didn't come right away was, as the Gemara suggests, is that this is meant to be a lesson for all generations, that the givonim, who were geirim, they were converts to Judaism, you know, and they have to be treated, converts have to be treated with the highest level of respect, and Shaul's treatment of them, by extension, through his massacre of the city of Nov, you know, is meant to be treated, you know, the most severe way possible. And, you know, it's meant to be a lesson in that way. And that's why Hashem didn't send the rains right away. So David takes, the Ramban rather, takes an altogether favorable perspective with regard to David. He says, look, David let it happen, but you can't really hold him responsible for what happened to these bodies and with these bodies. And he says, yeah, it's true that David buried them, but don't, you know, draw the erroneous conclusion that the fact that he buried them is an indication that he was responsible for what happened to them. David did it out of, you know, loyalty to the house of Shaul, l'chvod ha'malchus. Okay, so that's the Ramban's argument. And again, he takes, you know, a very sympathetic view to David's situation. So what I'd like to say, yeah, Mom, please.
Are we to assume that David did not bargain very hard for, you know, like Avraham, when he was told to destroy Sodom, he negotiated 50 people, 40, 30. Are we to assume David made no rebuttal to, did not bargain with the Givonim about the 7 people?
Right, so that's a worthwhile point to restate. So remember we had said, based on that Gemara Nivamos and Ayin Ches, that in the way the Gemara understood it, is that when David asked, you know, what do you guys want? And they said, Ein lanu kesef izahav, we're not looking for money, and we're also not looking, you know, for anybody else from Israel, that David was arguing the whole time. And remember we pointed out also that the way that the Pasuk is written is there's that this open space, and then Vayomer David and the Atain. So it sounds like he had great reservations about it. I can't say that he went quite as far as Avram did, because in the end of the day, right, he still allows it to happen. Avram never, you know, lifts a finger against anybody in Sodom, so it's probably a very thoughtful and helpful comparison, to be honest. But, you know, in the end, you know, David does go along with it, you know. So the Ramban's position is, you know, we have to see David's predicament, and David can't be held responsible, so on and so forth. Yeah, Charlotte, go ahead. Oh, Charlotte, I think you're on mute. Let me just...
Okay.
There you go.
I also thought it was interesting that it specifically says that when they hung them lifnei Hashem.
Yeah. What did you make of that? I agree, that is really interesting.
I don't know. You know, because was he making a statement, you know, to Hashem as opposed to Bnei Yisrael?
Right. I mean, the whole justification seems to be that the Gemara says, oh, you know, there was some legitimacy to this because, you know, the taking advantage of Geirim is such a horrible sin that nobody should ever do that again, right? So you would think Lifnei Bnei Yisrael would have been a more appropriate expression. Yeah, I thought that was related to... did you want to make a suggestion before I... did?
No, you can go for it.
No, Charlotte, by all means.
No, really, I just felt it was like very in Hashem's face.
Yeah, okay, so good. So that what I wanted to say was along those lines. So remember that Pasuk that we read together from Sefer Dvarim says, Ki kilalas Elokim taloi. So Rashi on that Pasuk quotes a Medrash, and he says... Mashal l'shnei achim. And he gives the following parable, that if a human body is disrespected, then ultimately it's like cursing God. In what sense? Because all human beings are created b'tzelem Elokim. So the mashal is, if that the king had an identical brother, and the identical brother of the king was executed, and his body was displayed, everybody would say, oh, the king is, been hanged. And it would be this terrible desecration. So the nimshal, right here in this mashal, is that anytime a human body is left exposed, it becomes, a great offense. Ki kilalas Elokim talui. It's like a curse of God. So I thought that Lifnei Hashem was related to that, right? Like you just said, in Hashem's face, that doing this is really, the most grievous kind of an offense as far as, the Tzelem Elokim in any human being. Apropos what we were saying before, that it doesn't seem arbitrary that the entire mitzvah of Kavura is extracted from a section of somebody who is guilty of the worst kind of offense. But it doesn't matter, because Tzelem Elokim is inalienable. It's just a part of a person. It can't, be lost just because, somebody did terrible things. So that was my take on Lifnei Hashem. I think you also wanted to... Charlotte, do you want to follow up on that, or... Satisfactory? Okay.
All right. No, it's not satisfactory, but I don't. There's a lot that's not satisfactory always. You don't always get answers.
Yeah. Very point well taken. Dad, go ahead.
There's also something which might be a little counterintuitive, since we're all kind of bashing on David, and I'm on that bandwagon as well. But
well, not the Ramban. Okay. Yeah.
But there is the expression Lifnei Hashem Titharu. So this is a terrible offense which was defiling the bodies, but maybe the Lifnei Hashem thing suggests he realized this was highly problematic, and he was hoping for some kind of purification.
I agree, and that's how I wanted to diverge from the Ramban. So the Ramban, again, takes the position that, why did David go ahead and then bury the bodies? Oh, it's just to sort of, to honor Shaul, the Chavod HaMalchus, but it wasn't like he felt any personal responsibility. So that strikes me as, unfaithful to that pasuk that we read. What is the intervening pasuk between when he hands over their bodies and he decides to bury them? Not just them, but Shaul and Yonatan, right? The pasuk says, Vayishma David, that David heard the way that Ritzbah conducted herself, the incredible dignity and courage that she demonstrated in protecting these bodies from any further denigration. And that catalyzes his behavior. I don't think it was the Chavod HaMalchus so much as David was, came to understand through her actions the importance of Tzelem Elokim in this regard, and was moved not just to bury these seven individuals, but to really correct what had become a historical wrong, that Shaul and Yonatan were never properly buried in their family kever, in their kever avos. So it strikes me that David actually, and as my father was saying, I think he was searching for some expiation here. But I think, what sort of points him in this direction is Ritzbah Varaya and her heroism and how she's able, to move him to a greater degree of humanity with respect to what happens to these seven and with respect to what happens to Shaul and Yonatan. And I think that this, is extremely important. And it takes us back, and this is the point that I wanted to conclude with, to the discussion that, Ina was pointing out before between David and Michal. Because there's no doubt that story is very much on our minds tonight. What's that conversation really about? So it happens to be that David is, dancing with the Aaron when he's transporting it to Yerushalayim. And Michal is really mortified by this. Like, you're the king. You can't be with the common people. You're above them. And this is entirely contrary to the way my father, conducted himself. And I'm appalled. you really are a commoner. And David's response at the time, you know, with his purity of heart was, and we see it as paradigmatic, right? David gets all the credit in the world, and rightly so for this, is on the contrary. I don't have any, you know, need to, you know, stand on ceremony. I'm perfectly comfortable dancing with the people. So what's that really about? It seems like that conversation is really about the fact that David has this deep respect for the Jewish people. He understands very much that he's their servant, that each one of them is, as we would say, an olam malay, a world unto themselves. And that's, you know, a motivator for him. The question is, you know, was he able to maintain that point of view? Sometimes probably better than others. And I think it must have been a source of like deep embarrassment for David when he heard what Ritzpah Varaya was doing. Just think about this for a second. You know, the same David that had told Michal in that conversation, you know, I have so much respect for everybody, Imam Ahos, the maidservants, I have no problem dancing with them. So here you have a woman, she's a Pilagesh, right? She doesn't, you know, have any voice, so to speak. And her two sons are amongst the seven that get taken. You know, maybe my mother is right. Maybe those were the only option. I don't know. You know, that's an open question. And you know, at the very least, if David was going to hand them over and they were going to leave the bodies there, then, you know, you would imagine that David could have, maybe, in my view, should have provided, you know, some measure of, you know, protection for them. You know, again, he takes the time to ban the Givonim from ever marrying into the body of the Jewish people. You know, what did he do for these seven? Instead, the mother has to be the one to do it. The mother, the poor mother. That must have been like a moment of reckoning for him. And I think it is. And I think that's what, quote unquote, inspires him to go get Shaul's body and bury it properly, and Yonatan's body and bury it properly, and the seven and bury them properly. So I think the question that we're left with is part of the reference back to Michal and, you know, the story of David, who once deeply identified with the common people. He kind of lost that a little bit. Has he forgotten? And here you have this person, Ritzpah Vataya, who's suffered this, you know, unimaginable tragedy, her two sons. And here she is behaving in such a dignified way and doing whatever she can to provide dignity to the seven. And David hadn't lifted a finger and hadn't spared her that extra measure of suffering. And that spurs him into action. So, you know, again, contra the Ramban, who suggests it was just the Chavod HaMalchus, seems to me that David was deeply moved by this woman and deeply moved by her humanity, and maybe in her actions was able to rediscover, right, a little bit of a part of himself, that part of himself where he told Michal, "Unikalosiod mizos vaisi shafal benai," you know, I'm not one to stand on ceremony. And I'm not one to lord myself over anybody else. V'imam ahos asher amart, imam mikaveda, I respect the Jewish people. I respect them a great deal, no matter how, you know, common they might seem. And in that regard, you know, I think that Ritzpah Vataya is, you know, one of these characters that helps David rediscover his better angels. Okay, so I'm going to, you know, hold up my remarks here. Let me just open up the floor, see if anybody wanted to follow up or have any final comments before we move on from this story entirely. Again, the halachic result is that the Givonim become the halachic equivalent of Mamzerim, you know, fully ineligible to marry into the Jewish people. Ruthie, go ahead.
Yeah,